Hello again. Welcome everyone to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, former GE business leader and now founder and CEO of Shoshimworks, and global advisory firm for ecosystems and organizational transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing really how we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this podcast series brought to you by Shoshimworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing Shell's recently published edition of the energy security scenarios, the options available, and how responses differ by country depending on the priorities and resources at stake. My co-host today is James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Diane. Hello, everyone. My name is James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I help the engineers and the scientists there use AI to imagine and design, hopefully, better futures for humanity. Before NASA, I led technology teams in a series of startups from the social impact space, covering healthcare, education, diversity and equity, and even some cryptography. I spent the early part of my career working in the Bush and Obama administrations, the White House, DOD, DOJ, working on a smattering of issues at the intersection of tech and policy for the country. So I'm particularly excited to sort of see today and talk today about the specifics of scenario planning and storytelling and how those particular pieces can really influence policymakers and how they make those decisions, because I've been on the other side of the table and I want to know how to do this better. So really excited to talk with our guest today.
Fantastic. Thanks, James. This is going to be great. And again, with us for part two of this deep dive into scenarios is Geraldine Wetzing, Chief Political Analyst at Shell. Welcome back, Geraldine. We're thrilled to have you.
Hi, James. Hi, Diane. It's really lovely to be back. So yes, hi, everyone. I'm Geraldine Wetzing, as Diane said. And my role in Shell scenarios basically involves trying to pull in all the geopolitical trends that we see emerge and evolve across the world and pull those into the scenarios that we produce in Shell. But I also am very proud to kind of be the main geek in the team when it comes to scenarios, methodologies, and applications. So I would also say that my role also includes constantly innovating in the scenario space and trying to make sure that we just stay honest when it comes to the principles and the mindsets of scenarios. So thank you again for inviting me back.
Well, to have you, and can't wait to dive in. And Geraldine, we really enjoyed the conversation, our last conversation, and would love to double click into some of those issues that we had discussed. But let's set some broad context to get things rolling, if we could. If you can maybe give us some context regarding the ways that countries are responding to Shell's most recently published report of the energy security scenarios, what does that look like in terms of the content and the reaction, just broad brushstrokes?
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Yes. So we launched our new energy security scenarios last month. So really, they're very much hot off the press. We're very excited about them. And what's interesting about these scenarios is that we actually include country archetypes as well. So these are more granular than our previous sets of scenarios, which also makes them more interesting for external stakeholders because they are more tangible and they're closer to home. So the response so far has been absolutely overwhelming, Diane. We've had some really good feedback. And because there are a lot of resources online, so you can go and dig into the data, we've also had a lot of requests for further information because there's a lot in there. So far, so good, Diane.
Fantastic. Yeah, I can only imagine that the world is feeling the pace and the amplitude of change. And having Shell kind of keep an eye on that horizon and give us some good insights regarding what's ahead and how to think about it is certainly helpful. James, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to sort of see a transition from the Shell scenarios, because I know the last time I sort of got to see a presentation by you and your team, Geraldine, was a slightly different set of scenarios. Can you, maybe for our audience, it might be worthwhile sort of digging in a little bit on sort of what those prior scenarios were and why the change was sort of necessary for this new hot off the presses, alterations or updates. What are the differences? What were the drivers there?
Yeah, so back in 2020, we were pretty much ready to launch a brand new set of scenarios. It had been probably about 7 years since we'd set sort of launched scenarios. So we were ready to set loose our new scenarios, and they were going to be called energy transformation scenarios. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. So we had to really think hard as to the content, those driving forces, the different characteristics in the scenarios that we had, and whether they actually still made sense given the pandemic. So we decided to take the pandemic and think not in terms of what is the pandemic or how the pandemic itself could evolve differently across regions, but we actually thought, let's focus on how countries might emerge from the pandemic in different ways. So our starting point for the scenarios that became really as economies recover. And we found quite soon that actually the soonest that economies would recover from the pandemic would be at least 18 to 24 months, right? So we already had the insight, this is going to be a while, there's going to be lockdown, it's going to be difficult to reopen uniformly across the world. So that was an interesting insight. But those scenarios, those energy transformation scenarios that we then published in February 2021, were based on three different, let's say, emphases. Depending on where societies place the emphasis for the recovery would determine the nature of the scenario that they would end up in, right? So we had three. We had the first one was called waves. And the wave scenario was premised on the ideals of growth. That really coming out of the pandemic, at all costs, mind you, it was all going to be about growth and returning to that previous GDP growth that we had before the pandemic and even before that. Right. So that was the first scenario. The second scenario was actually premised much more on, it's actually, I would say, distrust, because it's really about taking care of yourself, right? Your own economy. What the pandemic has taught us is that we are not resilient. That maybe we have too many eggs in one basket and we're too dependent on outside sources. So we need to pull in, we need to rein in and become more self-sufficient, more resilient and secure. So it's a real security mindset. So that one was called islands. Why? Because the more we start to look inwards and the more we detach from others and try to become independent. So you get this islands mentality. And then the third scenario was based on well-being. The idea that we've learned from the pandemic that actually we can take accountability for our own actions, that actually the state and government can really effectuate change, and that actually well-being is important for the society at large, not just health, but also climate. And so that scenario actually was called Sky 1.5, because we saw in that scenario the potential for us to actually reach the targets of the Paris Agreement. Right. So that kind of became our normative scenario, the scenario where we have the targets of net zero emissions, that we stay below 1.5 degrees, and then we worked our way back. The other two scenarios were a little bit different, right? The wealth scenario was huge growth, lots of emissions, and then a sudden realization far too late that it was too late. And so then you got very abrupt carbon, let's say, responses in different economies to the shock of being too slow. Whereas in islands, actually carbon adjustments, decarbonization, climate change is just not high on the agenda. So that scenario was actually the slowest decarbonization scenario that we had. Okay, now fast forward just 1 year, just 1 year. And we have the invasion of Ukraine. Now, you could not have dreamt up I don't want to say better countries, because this is not a good thing, but you could not have picked two countries that would have had more of an impact on the energy system. Because Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Russia being one of the largest oil and gas producers in the world, but also that supplies one of the largest demand centers for that oil and gas, which is Europe, and therefore invading Ukraine, which has leanings towards wanting to be closer to Europe, you couldn't have made it up. So when that happened, when that invasion happened, we immediately went to work to understand what kind of repercussions this would have on the energy system. And what we quickly found out was that actually this was going to be a long, drawn out conflict, and where the repercussions on the energy system would actually be long, drawn out, and worldwide, world-reaching, very far-reaching, not just in terms of energy prices, but also in terms of the commodities like fertilizer, fertilizer prices were then going up and becoming unaffordable for economies. But we also then, of course, had the wheat exports and the food insecurity. So we quickly thought, thinking and looking at the systems map that was emerging, that this was truly profound. We needed to relook at those scenarios. And of course, the one scenario that really stood out was the islands scenario, which is that scenario that has the longest decarbonization sort of tail, right? So the process was for us to think, okay, is the island scenario, and we actually lived in a world where we called 2022 was for us, we were all plunging into islands. This is basically how we kind of felt, right, when we were producing these scenarios. And so we looked at islands and we tried to understand, given these very specific dynamics of energy security issues now being the main driving force in the scenario, does the island scenario change in any way? And actually, we found that it did. So we did more work on islands. But then, of course, we also needed to think about Sky 1.5, because that is our decarbonization agenda. That's really where we need to be. As a world, we're all trying to get to this Paris Agreement. So what does it do for the Sky 1.5 scenario that does achieve those targets? So we revisited that scenario as well. So the new energy security scenarios are basically, they were born out of the energy transformation scenarios, but the island scenario has been updated, and I mean really completely updated, and is now called archipelagos. So the naming has a link, and the Sky 1.5 scenario is now called Sky 2050. And they are both different, and we've had to do the modeling behind both of those scenarios, because in Shell, it's not just a qualitative narrative, so the storytelling is still very important, James, but it's also about the quantification, because we're talking about energy system, and the numbers need to make sense as well. So the entire energy system has been mapped according to those two scenarios.
So I do want to sort of clarify something, make sure our audience is following along. So these scenarios are not really describing individual country responses. These are sort of global representations of cooperation. The US can't be, quote unquote, in waves, and the UK in islands. So unilateral action, while it might disrupt some of these scenarios and some of this cooperation, this we're talking about sort of interconnected ecosystems, and sort of we all sink or swim into islands or not. Is that sort of a fair assessment?
Well, yes. So when we produce a set of scenarios, we always acknowledge that as a global community, we are never 100% in either if you've got two scenarios, in either of the scenarios or any of the scenarios. The reality is that certain regions, certain countries will be leaning more towards one or another. That's the reality of it. So you're always going to be sort of swinging, let's say, like a pendulum between your scenarios to some extent. However, when we said we were plunging into islands, we meant we were all being sucked sort of towards this island sort of scenario, right? So that's basically the mentality. But what's new about these scenarios, James, is that energy security is such a fundamental piece of any economy, right? And so when we attack energy security, or when there's an energy security crisis, there is no economy that is immune. And what we found is that different economies were responding to the energy crisis differently, quite simply because of their own resources or their own capacity to absorb shocks. So what we wanted to do, and this is what's quite new about these scenarios, is that we wanted to add archetypes, which means that we have now got these four buckets of archetypes. And these countries are basically separated depending on two parameters. The first parameter is, do they have abundant or sufficient energy resources, domestic energy resources? Yeah, so that, do they have a security of supply? And the second is, are they able to absorb price shocks? And actually, it's interesting that if you see the different countries around the world, you can start to bucket them in one of those four sort of categories. And so we've called them we've got these archetype names, right? So we have these four archetypes. Now, the first is called Green Dream. Green Dream countries are countries that are actually quite short on domestic energy. So they actually have to import a lot of their energy. But they are quite wealthy countries by and large. So these guys can absorb the shocks. They can afford to import higher price energy. However, what they will do is they will try and move away from that as fast as they can to a more resilient domestic energy system, which is probably going to be driven mostly by renewables. Europe is a great example of a green dream set of countries where that is exactly what's happening right now. The question is, how fast can they transition? What are the bottlenecks in that transition? And of course, it will mean that they will need to reduce demand. They will need to increase efficiency so that they can actually make that ride smoother. The question is, though, how smooth is it going to be? The second group of countries are called innovation wins countries. So here, let's flip it around. These are countries that have abundant domestic resources, but they are sensitive for different reasons to price volatility. So if you take your own very, very fine country as an example, right, you have abundant resources, but beware when the gas prices go up, right? It becomes a political issue, right? So this is a very sensitive topic. So what happens in innovation wind countries is that they will produce more of their domestic fossil fuels, if they have them, to buffer the price volatility that we believe is going to be in play for quite a while, until they innovate their ways to new technologies, disruptive technologies that will then make for a new system. Yeah? So that would be the second bucket. The third bucket is Great Wall of Change. You can guess who that is, right? So that's China, of course. Now, China, interestingly, has a lot of domestic resources, also including coal, and it has the ability to absorb shocks. So the question with China is not so much as will there be an energy transition? Will they decarbonize? But it's actually more, will they decarbonize just their own domestic economy? Or how much of their neighboring economies and the economies that they can reach through the Belt and Road Initiative, will they also help to decarbonize with all of those clean technologies that they're developing? And the last group of countries, now I say the last group of countries, but these are the most significant countries because these are the surfer countries. And the surfer countries are the emerging and developing economies. And this is where the growth is going to come from. And this is significant. When you think about the growth in the world, not just in terms of numbers of people that are going to be coming to join us on this great planet, but also in terms of where they are now in terms of their poverty level and where they're likely to go, right, in terms of alleviating themselves out of poverty, we're going to see a huge demand surge from these countries in particular. And so it's very important to try and observe if these guys are going to leapfrog in terms of their technology choices. Right? How are they going to grow as economies? And then also, how are they going to be relating to the other three groups, which arguably at the moment are the economic drivers of the world, right? So how do they relate to these other three? And are they going to have to make choices with whom they partner and whom they trade? Or can they actually seek out opportunities? And what I also find interesting is that actually a lot of these countries are the ones that have a lot of potential in terms of nature-based solutions, right? And geological sinks, right? And when we think about the agricultural sector and the importance of the agricultural sector for carbon emissions, it's these countries. So they have a huge role to play and there's a huge potential there for them to leapfrog into the future. So stand back, four archetypes, right? And you can think about any country in the world and you can probably put them in one of these four buckets. And so now what I want you to do is I want you to think, okay, so this is the state of play. This is what they have, right? Now we have two scenarios. We have the archipelago scenario and we have the Sky 2050 scenario. And all these countries will behave differently if they end up in an archipelago scenario or if they end up in a Sky 2050 scenario, given the constraints and the opportunities that they have before them, right? And just to very quickly tell you then what these two scenarios are, archipelagos is a scenario that is fundamentally driven by a sense of having to secure your own interest first, right? So it's self-interest that is really driving decision-making. And that's economic, but it's also in terms of energy, it's in terms of food, but it can also be in terms of military security as well, right? Because this is the scenario where tensions grow between countries. And you can imagine that all of those anxieties around the geopolitical tensions play out in this scenario. The second scenario, Sky 2050, that is the scenario where we actually start to see that the self-interests are actually now moving more towards climate security. And for climate security, there needs to be a level of collaboration, but actually it's also about competitive decarbonization. So actually decarbonizing your economy becomes a competitive need, right? So it's almost more of a healthy competitive emergence that you see in Sky 2050. And that gets us to those two normative endpoints that we want to achieve, which are staying below 1.5 degrees and reaching net zero emissions by 2050 as well. I have to tell you, I don't think I've ever presented it so quickly and without my slides, because the other thing, of course, is that you said before, storytelling is very important. But we talk about the two crafts in scenarios. The first craft is the content. It's the analysis, right? So you've got to get that right. But the second is also your communication, how you communicate. And in the Shell scenarios team, and again, I will say, please go to the website, go to shell.com/scenarios, because you'll see actually visualizing what I'm talking about just makes the storytelling so much easier.
Maybe I can tie it together. So I was reading the report and I found it really compelling. And one of the things I thought was most interesting about the 2050 scenario that you talked about sort of earlier, some of the mineral access and sort of the change that the Ukrainian war is, that even in Sky 2050, if we move to a future with a lot of green energy, we need raw materials like lithium, cobalt, et cetera, to get there. So this is not, there are sort of these threads that are really interesting that sort of reflect the interconnectedness of every player, of all the four archetypes that are sort of real and tactile for people. It's like, oh, I remember during COVID that the shipping was really hard. Everything took months to get somewhere. So these are sort of lived moments that I think our audience would sort of recognize, like, oh yeah, no, I get that, that make those sort of scenarios sort of come together and congeal. So thank you for sharing that detail. But Diane, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, James. And Geraldine, just brilliant. And you've done a beautiful job at really kind of setting the landscape and the global landscape here. I kind of synthesizing and simplifying what is a very complex, dynamic landscape of change and opportunity and risk. But in our next episode, we'll be talking about where we move that forward from here, how we start to think about systems of beneficial outcomes. But I think today what we've done is establish the options and how we organize, right? Whether we're thinking about, you know, broad kind of global geopolitical landscape and energy security, or for a business competitive environment, there is a landscape of actors and implications and opportunities and risks that you've given us, I think, a really nice framework to organize that very complex and nuanced landscape and the actors within that landscape. So in our next episode, we'll be talking about the path forward and where we take it from there. But Geraldine, thank you so much. As we discussed last time, you've given us a lot to think about, a lot of tool that we can take back and our audience can take back. And I would just encourage our audience to continue to tune in. In our next episode, we'll be talking with Geraldine again about how leaders, companies, governments can begin to take action and make better decisions with this information that the Shell is organizing for us. So do please be sure to check out the next podcast episode, where we'll be chatting with Geraldine again. And follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com. Thanks, everyone.